Good morning, and thank you very, very much. How long does this blessing last for?
Plenary indulgence.
Plenary indulgence. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly. That's completely what I need. Gosh, thanks. I'm humbled, and I'm also a little nervous because I know that what do I really have to tell you? Last night I and one last thing to those. Can you hear me? Is this? Should it be a little bit louder? I can put here.
Yeah, that's good.
This might, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I can hear it. To those who were there last night, please forgive the overexposure, but it'll be completely different, I promise, today. As you know, the only reason I'm here, I suppose, is the politeness of the people that invited me, but also the fact that I am Irish. So I'm supposed to be sort of bringing you a report on Celtic Christianity, from the source. I don't trust anything I say about it, I assure you. So that's point number one. But then when I got a little more serious about it, I thought about what that might mean. And then I mentioned I read this book, and I realized that really I could largely forget about that, and instead remind you that you should, like any professor, for today you were supposed to have read chapter 8, folks. We can have the quiz. We can have the pop quiz in 10 minutes. But no, I retreated into the chapter. I said, well, here is a text. I can read this. I can say something about that. So what I thought I would do, if this is all right, is talk to you a little bit, I really give you two parts to the text. Just a short part in the beginning about Celtic Christianity, just a few thoughts on it, and then I would like to talk a little bit about chapter 8, in more detail perhaps, about chapter 8 of this book, which I think is incredibly interesting, at least it was to me. Thanks for the beautiful introduction. And the word skepticism was already mentioned in the middle of the introduction, because last night I talked about that. So I guess I am a skeptical person, and maybe Irish people aren't supposed to be skeptical. But it would be remiss of me not to tell you, first off, that I'm pretty suspicious of the phrase, Christ of the Celts, or certainly a phrase like Celtic Christianity. And just to... If I might get that out of the way, first of all. I won't spend the whole hour being skeptical, I promise you. But let me just explain a little bit. And this would be an argument outside, the use of it in this book or any other book. But I've seen over the years various people who have nothing to do with religion, usually they have to do with politics, appropriating the term Celtic. Okay? Often for dubious reasons. Okay? For example, one of the pressing ones at the moment in Europe are a group in Italy called the Northern League. Do any of you know the Northern League? Yes. Is there any Italian in the room? Well, they're the Lega Nord, and they're a party in Italy that want to they're from the north, around Venice mostly, and they want to separate from Italy. But the curious, this is neither here nor there, except that when you see their flags, they're green, with big Celtic crosses on them. So what they've decided, or they tell their followers anyway, is that they are Celtic people. They've appropriated this Celtic symbolism, because apparently the Celts, before they got to Ireland, Scotland, etc., actually did come from that part of Europe there somewhere. Now, I don't wish to judge any political party, but the Northern League in Italy are a pretty weird group. So... I'm just giving an example of the appropriation of the term Celtic and the idea of Celticism. Now, we bring that back to, obviously in Ireland, you could say, that there has been, maybe about 100 years ago or 120 years ago, there was a sort of rediscovery by Irish people of the fact that they were Celtic. Okay. And, of course, a lot of it is historically accurate. They were Celtic. The Celts were this tribe who came to Ireland a few hundred years before Christ, and they were the dominant tribe that sort of made up, even genetically, the Irish. Okay? But I think a lot of the things that people talked about in relation to the Celts, especially how heroic they were, how close to the earth they were, how wonderfully they treated women, etc. When you actually check, those tales are often kind of exaggerated. Okay? So, and in fact, you know, their history, they did replace a number of other tribes, and they didn't just replace them, they actually replaced them pretty brutally. So, you know, sort of a glorification of the Celts makes me suspicious. Not that they weren't wonderful in many ways, but, you know, they did have their faults as well, just to lay that out before you. So, in some ways, I suppose, where my suspicion comes from is that you would call it, I suppose, you know, to call a movement Celtic is to engage in what you'd call a kind of primitivism, if you've ever come across this expression. You know, you sort of take a group from the mists of time, you idealize them, and you attach them to what you're interested in. Just like, for example, if it had been called, for example, Christ of the Navajo, I mean, I think the big analogy in America is the way that often a Native American tribal stuff gets kind of taken over by us, the very people who are responsible for grinding that, you know, most of those tribes into the ground. We sort of, after having ground them into the ground, we then sort of start admiring them as kind of having these kind of earthy values that we feel we've lost. And of course, once you actually check the history of that tribe, they were probably pretty nasty people as well. You know, it's not like, you know, it's a kind of an idealization. That's what I mean by primitivism, going back to some kind of story way back, often in some sort of misty past, idealizing it and sort of appropriating it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's where my skepticism would come from. Another that'd be one piece of my skepticism. I'm not sure if it's true or not. I mean, you have to find your inspiration somewhere, right? The second term I would throw at you then would be some sort of, like almost kind of a paganism. You know, the Celts were not Christian. They may have believed in gods and things, but they weren't Christian. So what's going on when a Christian says, I will find my inspiration precisely, you know, in the place where
it wasn't.
Where it wasn't. I'm just pointing that out. Okay. There's, again, nothing wrong with doing it. But it's a curious sort of a, it's a kind of a, the Christian who desires to be a pagan, literally. You know? I'm challenging your faith here this morning, excuse me, just for a few minutes before I get on to the main course. The third thing I suppose I would see it as, and here's the third plank of my sort of critique, would be, it's, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase deism. There's a history of at least in, you know, I'm an English professor, and there's a history in English literature, a strand which people might call deism. And deism, I suppose, is, as to the extent I know much about it, and I don't, and I'm sure it's quite a specialized field of study, but to the extent I understand it, it's about as religious power began to wane, and as people started moving, say, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century into cities, they began to kind of admire nature incredibly, and start loving nature. You know, and it wasn't like a love of nature. Well, you know, those kind of poems that talk about the countryside and the sky and the, you know, the pleasure of nature. Well, at a certain point, you get poets who get so intense about nature, they're sort of losing their official religion, but they're loving nature, and they kind of transpose. They become mystical about nature to the point where basically nature is God. You know, and I think that would be sort of a deism. You know, God is everywhere in nature, which isn't strange for any theology, obviously. That's what, you know, most religions, I think, believe. But it's, again, is it on the one hand a kind of an attempt to, it's like going back to paganism. You know, at what point does the admiration for the earth become something other than? I mean, I think a lot of this book is saying you can do both, right? You know, the important thing is to bring both together, not separate them. Yes, but at the same time, I think perhaps religion is, you know, wouldn't we have religion if the earth and all that stuff wasn't there? Shouldn't, you know, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Does it really need that? I'm just pointing that out. That's deism. So primitive, just for those of you who are taking notes, it used to be all the quiz folks. There's primitivism, there's a sort of neo-paganism, and there's a deism at work. And each of them are wonderful, but that's summing up rather too fast, perhaps, but the sources of my skepticism about invoking the Celts as our sort of touchstone. Now, that said, I then sort of, and this is, these are just some random thoughts, and excuse me, I saw somebody already had an interesting map of Ireland in their notes, and you may have heard about this already. When I began to think about what would, if I accept the idea that there's such a thing as Celtic Christianity, or in my case, say, Celtic Catholicism, because I'm Catholic, I thought to myself, well, what would that mean for somebody who, you know, is just approaching it? And I have just a few things to say about this. And one thing is, obviously, you know, I was struck by the role of Iona, you know, and the world of Saint Columba, Saint right, Colum Kill, but especially Iona and the idea of place. Obviously, you know, that lovely thing he talked about in this chapter about the pilgrims to the island. They make a pilgrimage and they started going to the church without the roof. Did you come to that? You know, they started praying in that church. And I thought, well, you know, in Ireland there are no shortage of those kind of places. There are thousands of ruined houses, but also thousands of ruined abbeys. Okay? Nearly all the abbeys, the medieval and pre-medieval, pre-Middle Ages, the abbeys that were founded by St. Patrick and his followers, by all of these Irish saints, including St. Bridget. She was, you know, in many ways, at least in the official history, the first Irish nun. Can I tell you a couple of stories about St. Bridget? Let's open a parenthesis. She was, you know, Ireland's first feminist as well, right? And, of course, you know, I told you about that book. I have a friend who wrote a book largely about St. Bridget, and her claim is that, of course, she was a pagan earth goddess whom the Catholic Church sort of took over and turned into, you know, the first nun. Right? So there are lots of stories about her, and a lot of them, you know, in this Irish sort of storytelling, mythological tradition, and often they do stress her female independence. For example, she's associated with County Kildare, which is a county beside Dublin. Kildare, I think, is the church or the wood of Dara, another saint. And she was setting up her convent in Kildare, which is not the biggest Irish county, but a sizable county in Ireland. And she went to the local chieftain and she asked him for a plot of land. And of course, being a woman, he sort of laughed at her, you see? So he said in reply, and he thought he was very clever, he said, "You can take off your cloak and spread it on the ground, and I'll give you the piece of land of that size." Okay? So the story goes that she took off her cloak, spread it on the ground, and with God's help or whatever, it spread out to cover the whole of County Kildare. One story about St. Bridget. It's all true, you know.
There was a guy named Christo that used to do that too.
That is true. He deserved that. Yeah, he got in on that racket, so he's made a very, 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 a very good career out of it, right? In fact, he was in Ireland, you know. He covered St. Stephen's Green in Dublin one time, apparently. But, good point. what struck me, I suppose, is you know, the story of these ruins, the ruined monasteries in particular, of which there are, you know, there are lots of famous ones, but then there are lots of unfamous ones as well. They're scattered everywhere, but the roofless church, you know, on the broken cloister, right, that were often pulled down at the time of Cromwell, or at the time of the so-called penal laws in the 18th century, when Catholics were incredibly discriminated against in Ireland. And so one point I would make to you, and I'm not sure it's made in this book, it might be because I haven't read it all, but that the Irish Church in many ways, especially the Irish Catholic Church, and Irish Christianity therefore, is very much a religion I suppose the funny way to put it would be a religion with the chip on its shoulder. But a religion kind of of the underdog, you know, for better or worse.
The Fighting Irish of Notre Dame.
Yes. Well, of course, and that's Notre Dame, a Catholic college, you see. So, you know, if you sort of think historically, if you think of the history of Christianity in Ireland, it's very much a history of oppression and suppression until about 150 years ago, a bit less, which might sound like a long time ago in American history, but in the memories of Ireland, it's only a short time. So there is this kind of, you know, which those monasteries are a very eloquent testament that, you know, they were burned down, most of them. The people were killed or thrown out of them. Right? All of that glory was taken away. But the people never gave up the faith, right? You know, although they were often invited to. Now, obviously, I don't mean to distinguish between Catholics and Protestants. That's a whole other story that we could go on about ad nauseam in relation to Ireland. But just in general, there is that strand in Irish religion that a simple appeal to the Celts kind of gets to leave all that out. You know, all the stuff between the Celts and now. You know, in some ways, what you need to do is think of it through history. Perhaps, if you know, you're the product of that history. And that would be one thing I would bring up to you. But even more generally, I think there is, and this would be more in keeping with what Philip Newell is saying in his book, and I think it's very true, is that the Irish landscape is connected to whatever religious or spiritual sense there is in Ireland in a very unique way. And not just these monasteries, but there's a whole, which I think is, you know, it's interesting anyway, talking about that shrine in New Mexico and then another place, but that the relationship, not just you're thinking spiritually about, you know, communing with nature, but the idea of the importance of religious sites as kind of markers in landscape, so that the whole landscape sort of ends up almost having a sort of a spiritual quality through those sites is definitely there in Ireland. And I would think it influences the way most Irish people think about Ireland. In a way, no offence, but frankly, this landscape doesn't have it. It's too new in the country, or, you know, right? You know, you're approaching the landscape, you can be spiritual in it, but it's not sort of cast as inherently spiritual. Let me give you a few examples. I mean, in Ireland, there's not just all these, say, ruined monasteries or castles or whatever, but also you have this kind of, for example, one thing you have everywhere are so-called holy wells. You know? And I don't know if anyone has talked about this, but the holy well, you know a well? Mm-hmm. You dig a well, you keep digging in your backyard and it comes water. Well, wells, obviously, are really fascinating things, you know, for not in Ireland because we've lots of water, but the idea of drinking water, of good water, of the well, as being the place where you can found a community, a village. You've got to have the water, okay? The drinking water. So wells, I think, even before Catholicism, before Christianity in Ireland, were definitely sort of often, you know, important place, maybe even sacred place. But with Christianity, they became often, they were cast as so-called indeed hope. There, in my village, there's a St. Bridget's well. I don't know if anyone goes near it now, but even when I was a child, to go there, you knew that was a kind of a, you know, people who were sick, you know, would go there and maybe leave a rosary bead or something. So even if they didn't believe in anything, we're talking truth, they probably completely believed, the sort of accretion of feelings and intense sort of longings and hopes and dreams around that place, the people who had gone there, you know, that's a strange, interesting, you know, that the spirituality sort of accrues, okay? And it comes, I mean, if it was just the name St. Bridget's Well, why did it call that? Was she there? I don't think anybody knew. But you'd have St. Bridget's Well, St. Patrick's Well, you know, and all these Irish saints' well. I'm sure there are St. Tom Kill's wells here and there. Yes. So, and these are often sort of rough, you know, they weren't big fancy monuments. They were really folk religion. Yes. And then there's, you know, there are so-called holy mountains. For example, the most famous, and it's still, if you go to Ireland, you should go, it's called Crowpatrick. C-R-O-A-G-H. Do any of you know this? Yeah. You might have timed this. Has anyone timed this? Oh, me too. Well, Kirkpatrick is this, you know, none of the mansions in Ireland are that dramatic, except because they're beside the sea, they look dramatic. They're not that high by our standards here. But it's a mountain that, it's where St. Patrick is famously supposed to have driven the snakes out of Ireland. St. Patrick, and I think this is true, quite possibly did spend 40 days of Lent on the top of Kirkpatrick in the year 430-something, or 440-something, after he came to Ireland. St. Patrick, you know, was a real person. He did come to deny that. But the mountain is famous because he's supposed to have spent his length on the top of his fasting. It's incredibly dramatically situated overlooking the Atlantic and Kew Bay. And every year, you can climb it any time you like, but there's a pattern. There's a kind of a folk, not set up by the church, not official, but thousands and thousands of people, especially country people, do it on a particular, I think it's the last Sunday in July, or is it the first, you have this climbing the reach called in West of Ireland and all around. The only time I did it, it was the first time I was a teenager, and it was the first time I was surrounded by a whole group of people speaking Gaelic. They were doing it, growing up. And it's not even that hard to climb, except often it's pouring rain or it's drizzling hard. Coming down is a bit more scary. Did you find the river? Did you find that? You have to come down to this kind of stony area that is so frightening. But it's a few thousand feet high, and at the top, among the swirling mists and the rocks, there's a kind of a brutal chapel, and there was mass, and we all came back down.
I was wondering if in this country it's not so much a sacred place here and there, but there's a certain sacred or spiritual quality to movement, you know, across the landscape, the migration from one place to another for a better life, a better future. I think probably a fairly high percentage of people in this audience
have moved,
came here from somewhere else. So the spirituality has to do with that movement rather than any particular destination.
No, completely. But at the same time, apart from maybe the Mormons, who thought of that movement as a pilgrimage? You know, I mean, in a way, Mormonism, you know, there's a movie I remember seeing on late-night television a few years ago about the Mormons coming. And they did think of it as, you know, a kind of a mass movement of people, but it was also kind of a God-ordained pilgrimage. And it's a fascinating idea, you know, that you know, like in a way, going to Kirkpatrick is a pilgrimage. Or, you know, like, you know, the whole idea of that in going to Compostela or going to, you know, the Holy Land or whatever. The religious voyage. The voyage for the sake of religion. Whereas coming west, you could. But it's not that, you know. I think, let me give you the last example of the Irish pilgrimage and the Irish slaves that were trying to say it. Here's what, I don't know if any of you heard this. There's a place in Ireland called St. Patrick's Purgatory. Have you? I have not done this, but I'd like to do it. And it's a very well-known thing in Ireland, but again, it's a sort of a, it's not a, you know, it's not a big official thing. In a lake in Donegal, sort of in the rainiest corner of the country, there's an island. And this island, truly from the 6th or 7th century, was a place of pilgrimage. For no particular known reason, except that it became, that apparently in the Middle Ages, they actually thought it was the entrance to hell. Or at least purgatory. I remember reading this. But that's not what people know of anymore. It's just sort of, literally for no particular reason, St. Patrick again is supposed to have spent, you know, maybe a Lent or a time there fasting. But it's become this place where, what happens anyway, now there's a number of trees, you know, it's all built, it's a strange island in this remote lake, all built with a big church and various dormitories. Because people, again, often just very ordinary, unassuming people, go there in their thousands. And you're supposed to spend, I think it's 3 days, I remember the whole thing. You can go, they have a website now, you can go and read about it. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, they're getting into more mild and modified debates. You can do two or three different options. But the main option, I think you go for 2 days, maybe it's like just two altogether. You try not to sleep for the whole time, and all you do is you can have black tea and I think a couple of slices of dry bread in the time. And of course, usually it's pouring rain. And you don't just sort of sit around thinking about this. There's a whole prescribed set of prayers, a lot of them outside, you know? People sort of go around in their bare feet, doing all these through the rocks. It's a very strange sort of ritualistic thing. But you could imagine how, even if you weren't religious at all, it could do you all the good in the world if you're a survivor. But also, there's a kind of a mystical quality, you know. It's an attempt to reach some sort of mystical state, I think, as well. But isn't it strange, this kind of connection of the landscape to the religious thing? That's there in that place and in every little well. And a lot of this stuff, of course, is dying out. But in a curious way, it still survives. You know? I mean, a number of famous Irish poets have written poems about Loch Derby, the St. Patrick's Purgatory. So I suppose my thought is, my last thought, and then I'll talk to you more about the Frenchman whose name I have horrible nervousness pronouncing. But my last thought, I suppose, is something like that. If there is such a thing as Celtic Christianity, the first point I suppose I made was that it is a religion that, or Christianity, that might, because of the history, feel it's sort of the religion of the underdog. The second one would be that, I suppose, in some ways, you could say that in Ireland there is a sort of an ordinary people, a kind of almost underground, not underground really, but a religion that kind of goes along in parallel with or underneath the official Roman or whoever, Church of Ireland, if you want to think about the Protestants, or you know, that there is perhaps a tradition of kind of almost like folk religion that has never died out. That might have a, you know, that through that the kind of the ordinary people, nobody pushing them or telling them they have to do it, who go and do these things. And it's not some tiny remote little sect I'm talking about. It's, you know, broad, including people from the cities and everything, would go to Loch Derry, you know, in the summer. And that's a cute, there's a whole, almost a kind of a folk spirituality in that, I think, that sort of survives. And, you know, might be the big, I mean, you've all heard of the scandals in the Irish Catholic Church, probably, of which there have been more even than there have been here. You know, and the Celtic Tiger in the last few years has meant there's been a huge drop off in the power of the Catholic Church and, of course, the power of the Church of Ireland as well. So, you know, official religion in Ireland is on a pretty shaky footing these days. So perhaps, you know, you could at least make a case that there is a sort of a local, ordinary folks, almost folk religion, still alive, that might indeed, you know, take inspiration from a book like this. You see, I'm not all skeptical. You know, if that makes sense. Yeah,
there's a wonderful book out. It's just fun reading. It's called McCarthy's Farm.
Oh, yes. I haven't read it, but I've seen
McCarthy.
Yeah.
And he goes on that pilgrimage with the bare feet and the fasting.
Oh, he goes to that. He goes to Loch Derg.
Yeah. And it's great reading.
Did he enjoy it, or did he?
not exactly.
No. No, I met a few years ago. I met a youngish American woman who had done it with her relatives in Ireland, and she was in complete shock. She thought it was some sort of weird primitive, you know, that these apparently reasonable people would be doing stuff like this. She was, you know, as a little sad young Californian, she found it the most frightening thing, right? I swear to you.
Well, I think people could think that if they go to a serious Jewish meditation group, same kind of deal. I mean, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
You can't do anything.
It's not that far from. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No. Anyway, so that's my just few thoughts on as speaking as an Irish person, okay, to you about all of this. Then I want, as I tell you, I have time, right? I've talked too long on this part of it. But I would like to talk also to you about, and here's my Irish pronunciation, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Okay? Yeah. Is that good? Thank you. I don't know very much about him, and I know that there are some people here who love his work. So forgive me if I'm sounding very naive, but it strikes me as quite a few things to say about it. And I don't know if this is all news to you or if this will be all new. But I did a bit of work after reading the chapter, and I tried to find out some more things. And I would just like to sort of share them with you, and maybe I will learn some things from you. As I was explaining last night, he lived from about 1880 to 1950, which just happened to be sort of the years, the very same years as most of the writers who I study, you know? That he lived, in other words, a life centered around World War I in many ways. Mm-hmm. And if any of you have European connections, you'll know that when World War I is kind of, was the biggest trauma of the 20th century in Europe, you know? Almost more than World War II, you know, with some obvious exceptions. World War II was no fun either, but for anybody. But World War I was kind of the great slaughterhouse, you know, in Europe. And do you mind if I just talk about him a little bit? Would that be of interest to people? I mean, I just like to. Yeah. I mean, and I don't have any I'm not evaluating what he's written. I just talk in a way about his context and how fascinating it is. You know, here you have somebody who, at the simplest level, what he's trying to do, it seems to me, is kind of reconcile the story of evolution with the story of religion, with Christianity. And as you all know, you know, you turn on the news even still and they're arguing about, you know, Alabama or Georgia, should they teach evolution in schools, right? So they're still on about that. And I'm not going to rehearse all those arguments for you. But in a way, that's at the heart of his contribution. You know, that he is sort of, those people should read him, right? Because he's trying to say, look, there's no problem whatsoever with evolution and that whole story in relation to Christianity. Quite the opposite. You know, that's what he's saying. I think that evolution is sort of the latest truth of the Christian message, and it's kind of amazing because he was a geologist. You know, when you read about his life story, he starts off collecting the rocks in the middle of France. You know, that wild area north of the Auvergne in France, and he collects rocks, and then he ends up as a paleontologist. You know, he starts as a geologist studying the rocks, and then goes on to studying the fossils and the fossil remains that were the basis for all those scientific discoveries about evolution, you know, starting with Darwin. Okay? So, just to tell you, I mean, it might seem strange to you now, but it was in the 19th century, you know, back in the Victorian era, it was geology. It was the new science of geology that truly was, to use an Irish expression, putting it up to Christianity. I swear, it was the geologists in the 19th century. Is there any geologist in the room who knows more of this history than I know? But if there was, you'd know. All those kind of the so-called fathers of geology were sort of coming along in the middle of the 19th century, and they were saying, look, and this might seem so old hat now, but it was very frightening to Christianity in 1850 or 1840. They were saying, look, the story of Adam and Eve is clearly complete hogwash. These stones are 2 million years old. They were dating based on rocks. And it was those people who truly sort of scared the hell out of, especially Catholicism. In some ways, if you look at the arguments then, you can see that was the moment that a lot of Catholicism started becoming reactionary and very nervous about science. You know, in the modern era. So here you come along to Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was a geologist, you know, right at the kind of moment when all of this was coming into crisis. And after being a geologist, he starts studying the fossils. So he was also an evolutionist. you know, he was one of those who was discovering the proof of the theory of evolution. And he was also a Christian. And he was a very intelligent person. So his whole life story was, how do you justify, how can you tell those two stories together? Okay? And just to try to sketch how I see he was doing it, let me give you just very briefly a couple of the stakes. I better not start explaining, because I don't really fully understand evolution. But why should evolution be a problem for Christianity? Obviously, you can see how the story of the rocks being thousands and thousands or millions of years old contradicts the Bible. So, by now, I don't know if there's any biblical literalist here, but by the middle of the 19th century, no person who had a brain could really be a biblical literalist anymore. Right? You understand that? You can't say the Bible is literally true. It's not. Adam and Eve are some sort of ideal figures, right? Etc., etc. God didn't make the world in a week and all that stuff. But that was a weird problem at a certain point, because they were still credibly being biblical literalists. So you remember those people who used to be discovering where Noah's Ark was and all that stuff? That's all. Serious people believed that. So there was a crisis, and you can see how those stories of the millions of years old world was a problem. Why was evolution a problem? Darwin comes along and he talks about how we're descended from apes. Obviously, you can see how there's an issue there. But even more fundamentally, I think, there's this idea, and it comes up in that poem of Tennyson, what he said about after Darwin, after the theory of evolution, you had to change your view of nature. And your view of nature, the phrase out of Tennyson was, nature red in tooth and claw. What was the theory of evolution? The theory of evolution was that we're all fighting with each other, all the animals are fighting with each other, and the toughest, biggest one keeps winning. Right? That's the theory of evolution. We're all competing, and the toughest one wins, and the toughest one has babies with the other tough one, and, the species improves. Now, that's a radically un-Christian message. By the way, it's very close to a capitalist message. But it's a radically un-Christian message. It's a message that we're all, nature red in tooth and claw. At a certain level, as a Christian, you've got to believe in goodness. You've got to believe that we're not just all fighting with each other, and the best one is murdering the others and having sex with the other person who, defeated their kids.
I think that in evolution is also a secondary major principle, and it's the theory of cooperation. And that is basically Adam Smith and those people that have popularized and presented to us in a dualistic way that survival of the fittest is equivalent to the theory of evolution.
Well, I mean, yes, and this is, I suppose, this is, if you allow me, it's a good entree to Pierre and Sagan, because, just to run through a little bit, okay, the First World War occurs, for him, the First World War, 1914, he has to go as a stretcher bearer, he's called up, he doesn't fight, but he's very, very, he sees war for 4 years, heaven, the most gruesome kind of war. Certainly proof of the nature red in tooth and claw. Not just nature red in tooth and claw, but human beings red in tooth and claw. They will murder each other for years. They will slaughter each other right before my eyes. And if you even read some of the things I read, he's kind of perversely attracted to it. It's kind of strange. And I think he's expressing what a lot of people in the war who weren't killed, of which millions were, felt. But around the same time, or a couple of years earlier, he read another character who was very popular in France at the time, named Henri Bergson. You didn't start reading Bergson unless you're interested. But Bergson is really fascinating. He wrote the book that most influenced Chardin was called Creative Evolution. And this is where some of the stories you're bringing up, I think, were sort of first there. The idea that evolution didn't have to be this story of brutal competition, in a kind of Adam Smith sort of way, but that you could tell the whole story as kind of as nature kind of literally on fire with energies, that might be harnessed for good as well as for kind of brutality. And I think if, at least in my limited knowledge of Pierre Dillard, Bichardin, that book was a kind of really fascinating turning point for him. Creative evolution. And he goes on then, you know, the big movement in France after the war and during the war was phenomenology. I'm not going to try to start explaining what I understand by phenomenology to you, but his own, what's the title of his own very famous book? The Phenomenon of Man, you see. And phenomenology, as you can imagine, is obviously has lots to do with, and this is brutally nothing if I have any philosopher or anything in the room, but obviously interested in not the essence of things, but kind of the grain of ordinary material reality and how we experience it. You know, you could imagine, you know, a phenomenon or a thing. How can I sort of experience the thingness of a thing? Or how do I exist? What does to be alive mean in the most ordinary, sensuous human way? Which on the face of it is kind of, again, the opposite to religion. But I think what Pierre Teilhard de Chardin is doing is reconciling that sort of story, which obviously has more to do with science. You know, science is doing that officially, talking about the real things in the world and looking at them as hard as they can and trying to describe them. And Chardin is saying something like, look, religion should do that too, instead of telling everybody that it's against that. That it's trying to be otherworldly, you know. And I think what happened with a lot of Christianity, very much in during his lifetime, from the time of Darwin on, is they got allergic, official religion got sort of allergic to science in general. So science got to be the field where, you know, the science took over the whole looking at the real world as we experience it. And religion got to be the world of, oh, I'm off in the clouds, and who believes me anyway? And whereas I think what he's trying to say is, no, those two cannot be separated. Now, of course, it was complicated in Catholicism, and he was a Jesuit, by the fact that officially Catholicism literally was terrified of science from the time of the geologist and evolution on. And officially, they call themselves anti-modernists. You know, they were against what they call modernism. And modernism was any story about technology and progress, literally. Because they saw it as creeping secularism. But, you know, they had a point. You know, they were right to be worried. But in a way, what Chardin is saying is something like, stop worrying and point out instead that the ins and outs of it, but it's something like... the idea that religion has more to say about phenomenology, about the real world and one's experience of being in it, maybe than science does, because science is so cut and dry. Okay? And he did this through offering, I think, his story about evolution. And it's very fascinating, and I'm only beginning to grasp what's in it. But again, I turn to fiction and poetry and stuff like that. And to sum up his theory of evolution, there's a short story collection by an American writer from the South, a Catholic writer named Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. One of those strange Southern Gothic-y writers, actually, so I recommend her to you. But one of her collections is called, and I guess it's kind of a short story, Everything That Rises Must Converge. And apparently she took this phrase from Chardin. Okay? Everything that rises must converge. And when I was reading the various web articles, I realized that there's a novel by one of the best living American novelists. His name is Don DeLillo. He had a novel a couple of years ago called Omega Point. And that phrase also comes out of Chardin. Because Chardin had this idea, it seems, that... Well, please forgive me if you know about this than I. But it seems that his story was that you know, to tell a positive story about evolution. He ties it to kind of the Christian story almost of the end of the world as a positive experience. You know, that we are, you know, the world is evolving and we are evolving in it towards something like an omega point, towards being truly godlike. Okay? So, again, there's the whole thing I was reading, and I don't know. I have in my notes here, I have the geosphere, the biosphere, and human consciousness as the three categories. What's interesting, again, this is moving very fast, but how I understand it is that evolution explains how the biosphere, you know, all life in the world, is changing, continually changing. And changing, presumably, for the better. You know, that's evolution. We don't go around like apes anymore. We're standing up straight. That's God-given. That's the biosphere changing. But what he ties that to then is that consciousness, what we think, what we feel, maybe our very sense, you know, you can start thinking of your senses. If human beings have changed, have evolved, you know, over millennia. Well, then you have five sense organs. They've evolved too. Like, you can see better. Maybe everybody saw black and white at a certain point. Now we see colors. In other words, life is, for us, richer because we have evolved. Can you buy that?
Yes.
Now, how do we make a leap from there to spirituality? Well, as we evolve, our consciousness, our ability to kind of understand the world, ourselves, and everything is improving as well. Okay? And where he's really interesting, I think, is what he's saying is something like there's a common consciousness, perhaps, that we might be moving towards. If you've read him a lot, please contradict me or correct me. You know, everything that rises must converge. That at a certain level, we will reach this, you know, what we're reaching towards is what he calls somewhere supreme consciousness. You know? That's what spiritual development is about. It's not, and it's all material development. The development of bodies and animals and the biosphere in general is all evolving. So is, and improving, so is consciousness. And that should lead towards more community, towards more communality. Because what is consciousness if we all go off in different directions? It's no use at all. And so that there's kind of, he has this, I suppose, at a certain level, it's an incredibly holistic story. You know, that evolution is occurring in the physical world. The world is this kind of vast flux of energy that comes out of Henri Bergson. But it's not just a formless flux. It's not just nature red in tooth and claw. It's actually improving. Presumably all under the power of a god, the omega point. And that evolution is perfectly understandable within a Christian, therefore a Christian tradition. Okay? And that at the heart of it, what we have to stress is the idea that as our senses develop and our consciousness and intelligence develop, we will end up having a greater sense, or we should have, greater senses of the possibility of community amongst ourselves. Okay? And that's part of that whole physical evolution. Okay? They're together. That spirituality and materiality are in an absolute continuum, all under the sign of a great design that must come from a Godhead. That's what he seems to be saying to me anyway. So he says, I'll give you a couple of quotes, there is nothing, not even the human soul, the highest spiritual manifestation we know of, that does not come from a universal law. Our human spiritual development is moved by the same laws as material development. And it's a mistake to divide them up. You know? So that the idea of kind of having your spiritual life as a breaking, you know, as kind of conquering your body and your physicality and the physical world. I guess he was against that. You know? Right? And I think that obviously is why he gets, you know, pole position in Christ of the Celts, which seems to teach a similar message, right? And obviously in our own time of global warming, etc. I mean, of sort of fear for our planet and what we're doing to it as a community. It's a very, very resonant message. You know, a last quote, there is a communion with God through the earth. That's a charming opinion to give, but it's more than charming would be the point. I mean, it's maybe beautiful, but it's also kind of an intense challenge that indeed your spirituality has to be a total thing, not something that you kind of do privately, not something that you do in retreat from the world or from the way that you are evolving as a person or your people or yourself as a human being have evolved over thousands of years, but rather that you must bring all of those things along together. Okay? I'm not really giving you a recipe on what to do. I have no idea what to do. But at the end of it, you know, he has all these wonderful expressions like a tide of life. And the last thing, I suppose, is, you know, one thing would be something, if you want me to sound more religious, is something like evolution is Christ's destiny for us, you know. Which is a fascinating, you know, that in a way religion and evolution almost become the same thing. You know, religious development and evolutionary development, you know, our religious development becomes a sort of response to Christ's evolutionary plan for us. But finally, and of course this would bring it back to maybe how you could behave, you know, the idea of love as evolutionary energy. And I forget which of these things I came across this in. But, you know, love. What is love except some sort of, let's say actualization, but that sounds like a terrible 60s word. You know, but making real of that kind of, you know, what is love for others? You know, making real that sort of sense of development of communities. You know, whether it's just a community of one other person along with yourself or lots of people. And that love itself is evolutionary energy. Like, we're destined to love. It's not something you have to turn yourself into a martyr to do and renounce the world to do. Quite on the opposite. That we are destined to do it. All we literally have to do is let it happen. Okay? And just by participating in that natural order, we participate in evolution, and we also, you know, which is the thing perhaps a lot of religions most fear, and on the other hand, or on the same hand, we also become, you know, more spiritual, if such a thing can go. Well, I suppose.